Orson Welles speaking and bringing you today a fairy story, a letter from Louis Armstrong, and a jam session. I'll get to that in just a minute.
For just a moment, let me tell you a little about the sponsor of this program, Lear Incorporated. The name is spelled L-E-A-R, and Lear makes fine radios. For 15 years, Lear radios were made especially for airlines and aviators. The Lear became known as the name men fly by. Of course, such radios must be as keen, as dependable, as easily handled as science can possibly make them. They must include every worthwhile late advance, because reliable radio makes flying safe. It's this kind of manufacture that Lear knows. It's the kind of craftsmanship that's going into the new home radios Lear is now building. These home radios will bring America's homes the very newest developments, such brand new advances as the Lear wire that remembers. This is a simple way to make lifetime recordings of the happy moments in your home, or to take radio programs right from the air and play them over and over as often as you wish. And anything you don't want to keep disappears from the wire when you record something else on it. You've never heard of recording like this before. In fact, you've never seen radios like Lear radios before. You'll want one in your home. More about them later on. Now, Mr. Welles brings you his views and opinions on events as he sees them. The opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of Lear Incorporated.
No views and opinions today. As I've mentioned before, these broadcasts come not from a radio studio, but from my home, specifically that dressed-up part of a basement generally known as a playroom. Today it's going to be a playroom for fair because we're really going to play in it. We're going to play some jazz. Real jazz musicians will do the playing. Don't worry about me. I'll be off mic tapping my foot. What's about to transpire is only a temporary improvement. Here's how it all came about. Louis Armstrong wrote me a letter. Louis writes wonderful letters, besides blowing the best horn this side of heaven. And because this one is all about his early days, which are the early days of jazz music itself, I thought I'd pass the letter on to you. Well, you know, friends have a way of dropping by at our house on Sundays in time to catch the broadcast, so I asked Barney Bigard and Zudie Singleton and Fred Washington to be sure and come today. Barney and Zudie, as you know, are to the clarinet and drums what Louis is to the trumpet, and they've been close to him since they were kids together in New Orleans. Hipsters will pardon me if I pause right here for a word to the squares. Jazz, like gumbo, could never have been invented if Africa and France, by way of the West Indies, hadn't gotten together in Louisiana and made a city called New Orleans. Like gumbo, jazz has many good things in it, some of them quite mysterious. And if gumbo isn't just something to eat, jazz isn't just something to listen to. Please be assured that jazz is not what you hear on the jukebox or the hit parade. Jazz can only be heard when a very small group of very great instrumentalists get together and feel right. If you hang around those men as I do and make a pest of yourself, you'll get to hear it every once in a while in somebody's hotel room, maybe, or in a nightclub after the joint is closed, backstage at the Paramount occasionally, or even on stage once or twice a year at Carnegie Hall. Off and on for a couple of years now, I've been trying to get a book ready on jazz and samba, and because the story of Louis Armstrong's life is pretty much the story of jazz, I've been pumping him for material. That's how come this letter I'm going to read. Now, Louis, like Barney and Zudie here beside me at this microphone, were growing up in New Orleans at the same moment jazz was growing up. They knew the great King Oliver. They played at the picnics, the Mardi Gras, and the political clambakes, where brass bands were finding that beat, which was to change popular music all over the world. They played everywhere, in the streets, in the wine shops, and yes, at the funerals, too. In New Orleans in those days, there was band music at almost every burying. Very sad and solemn it was as far as the cemetery, and then after the first shovelful of earth hit the coffin, the horn would take a hot lick and the whole crowd would swing out, high and solid and gay as 4th of July, all the way back into town. Younger men like Louis and Zudie and Barney here, his close friends, Fred Washington, took jazz up to St. Louis by riverboat. There's always a band on the riverboats, and finally to Chicago, where young white boys going to high school. Benny Goodman, just for example, used to sneak away from home at nights to go over to the South Side and hear the new music. Jazz, it was called at first, jazz, and then jazz. Well, I thought Zudie and Barney would enjoy hearing Louis's letter, so I asked them over with Fred Washington for breakfast, and they brought some friends, and the friends brought their instruments, so I prevailed on them to accompany Louis's letter with something appropriate. Perdido Street Blues. Louis, as you know, grew up on Perdido Street. Dear Orson, Louis writes, They had me busy as a one-legged man doing the Charleston. I couldn't even look at my typewriter, let alone beat out a few. I gotta write my boy Bing after this. After all, he's my man, too. Great cat. Yeah, I'm gonna lay a few chuckles on the old man. I call him Papa Bing anyway. Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt this. This is O.W. speaking now for an occasional footnote, and here I'd like you to know that Papa Bing Crosby would be the first to acknowledge his debt to Louis Armstrong. No good musician practicing the profession of popular music gets through a number without making use of some musical idea of Armstrong's, a riff, a break, a lick, a phrase, something. All the good arrangements of the stuff you dance to, which, remember, is not jazz, owe something to Louis's huge inventiveness. Now back to Louis himself and his letter. You know, man, he writes, I appreciate every iota of life. As the day when I was just a little baby boy, I was always musically inclined. And at the age of 10, I was singing tenor in the quartet, believe it or not. I don't know why my voice changed so far from there. I guess it was the later dissipations. And when we had this little quartet, we used to go along the street by twos. The lead and the tenor in front and the baritone, the bass in the back. And we'd walk down the street just singing and made our living by passing the hat. I took care of my mother and my sister off that money. There were many times my mother, my sister, and I, we couldn't eat. And we wasn't sick either. At the end of 1912, I'd say, because all this happened on New Year's Day, I'm beginning to tell how the old trumpet was born. A week before New Year's Eve, I happened to be ransacking my mother's old trunk, and I found a .38 pistol of my stepfather, one of those old-time muskets, one of those short businesses with a short barrel. The reason I'm talking about this particular pistol, because in New Orleans, around about Christmas time, during the whole week between Christmas and New Year's, they celebrate down there with firecrackers and explosives. They even shoot pistols. Now, you can get away with shooting pistols, but if the law tip up on you, well, it's just shame on you. So we usually go out every evening anyway with a quartet, so this particular Christmas Eve night, I want to be the most hip one. My mother was unaware of this all the time that I had this pistol. So just as we were going down Rampart and Pedito Street, there's some cat come across and pulled out a six-shooter and shot it up in the air. Well, you know how light a six-shooter sounds. Sounds like one of them firecrackers. And when he did this, the boys in my quartet commenced to egging me on. They say, "Get him, Dip." In those days, they used to call me Dipper Mouth. I received the Satchmo from the English when I went to London. So when they said, "Get him, Dip," I reached down in my bosom and pulled out this .38 musket and shot up in the air. Galoom! So after shaking all the buildings in the block, I noticed all of a sudden two arms hugged me. And I figured that was something strange, getting that kind of a hug. One of those clinging hugs. So I looked around kind of slowly, hoping it wasn't what I thought it was, and I'll be damned if it wasn't. It was a detective. So after I cried myself sick trying to plead to that man to turn me loose, they took me to the juvenile court. And from there, they took me to the waif's home for boys. Imagine a boy spending his New Year's Day in the Who's Cow. So the first day I was there, I tried to be a little tough, you know, kind of hinkty. Wouldn't eat the food or nothing. Man, one day my stomach commenced to meet my backbone, and when they tooted that mess call bugle, I was the first cat at the table. Each one of the keepers there at the waif's home had different things they taught the boys, so quite naturally I stuck to Mr. Peter Davis, who taught music, as I had music in my veins. Of course, I didn't know anything about the trumpet then, but he'd taken a liking to me right off the reel like King Oliver, and teaching it to me. Well, after learning Home Sweet Home on the coronet so well and fast, tone and everything, Mr. Peter Davis decided to make me leader of the little brass band, and boy, I did get in there then. Before you know it, I was knocking them dots off like the Allies romped over Europe. I used to blow all the bugle calls. My favorite was the mess call. I'd blow that mess call and beat everybody to the table. Well, after my mother got a release to get out of the waif's home, I formed a little boys' band with Joe Lindsay, and on Saturday and Sunday nights played back at Perdido and Franklin at Matriga's Honky Tonk. That's how I met King Oliver. He used to come there and stay the rest of the night listening to me. He'd play for me, and that'd knock me out. King Oliver used to kill me anyhow when I used to second line behind him in the parade. He'd come up in the street with the Onward Brass Band playing St. Louis Blues after leaving the cemetery, burying a brother. Sometimes I'd follow behind King Oliver all day, not even go home for dinner. He's always been my man. Joe Oliver, King Oliver to the fans, just taking a liking to me right off the reel. I was still young in those days. I used to go up to his house in the daytime on the weekdays and run errands for Mrs. Oliver and do little doodads for him. And he'd show me my lessons free. And I always wanted to live his life. Musically, anyway. When King Oliver went to Chicago, that automatically threw me in his place in Kid Ory's band, which was a big break for me, just a kid anyway, 18. Looked like that was the beginning of everything happening to me because that was the year I married my first wife, Daisy. I'd make it brief here to explain each wife alone would make a book as big as an encyclopedia or something. But we had a good time, though. What a thrill it was to me to walk in Lincoln's Garden to join King Oliver's band. There they were all sitting up there looking so fine. They struck up one of them high-powered numbers so powerful. Couldn't nobody get me to leave New Orleans, none of them except King Oliver. I didn't trust nobody else. I had so much confidence with the king, I used to see many of the boys returning home from up north. They didn't do so good, and that alone frightened me. And we was playing a funeral the day I received a telegram from King Oliver to me to come to Chicago. And I showed this telegram to Celestine, the leader of the brass band. He and the members was a little skeptical about me leaving, and the boys tried to show me the place where I shouldn't go to Chicago, saying, "You're young, something might happen." So I let them run their mouths a while. I told them, "I'm going to join a man I idolize. Whatever he's doing, I'm going to do it right with him. Because I've always lived the life of King Oliver, musically, from the first time I dug him." Then, in 1928, the Savoy opened, and I went in there, and Zooty was on the drums. All this time, Zooty Singleton. Everywhere I went, seems like he was right with me. Now, this is Orson Welles speaking again. If jazz has ever been played by a big band, and I'm accepting the Duke here, of course, it was played at the Savoy in the great days of the Savoy, and the Savoy blues are particularly associated with Louis Armstrong. My musician friends here at the house will please segue to that number by way of serenading one of the greatest musicians of our day. Well, after Connie's Inn, I went to Europe and we toured all over there among those crown heads. I had musicians of all nationalities in my band and they swung just like American boys. We're playing all the night spots up on the coast, getting ready to truck on back east, and I'll write you all the news from there. So say hello to all the fans and drop me a line sometime in your spare moments. Of course, I know you're a busy cat if there ever was one. Nighty night, and God bless you. Louie. Listening to the Savoy Blues, a serenade to Mr. Louis Armstrong, a very nice-sounding rumpus played in my rumpus room by some musician friends, warming up before breakfast for what is certainly the earliest jam session in the entire history of jazz. And now your attention, please, for an interesting announcement.
When you know that Lear has 15 years' background building ultra-fine aircraft radios, you get some idea of the excellence you can expect in the new Lear home radios. There's a whole line of them, good-looking, capable, and dependable. You'll find some with television, with static-free FM, with easily-tuned worldwide shortwave. And in the console set, there'll be an entirely new contribution to your convenience in adjusting the programs to your liking. How about the prices? Ah, there's the surprise. Because you'll probably anticipate that such fine radio instruments will be high in cost. The handsome console combination that tops the line and has television, automatic record changing, wire recording, and everything sells for about $500. And the neat, efficient table model sells at the $19.95 level. We know you'll want to hear these Lear radios. That's the best way to realize what these sets have contributed to radio enjoyment. We'll tell you just when your nearby Lear dealer will have them. And when you do hear them, we know you'll agree that you get the most value for your money when the radio you buy has the nameplate Lear, L-E-A-R. And now, a final word from Orson Welles.
No more words, just another note or two of music, and please let me come to call again. Thanks for this time. Until next Sunday, same time, same station, my sponsors, the makers of Lear Radios, and I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is the American Broadcasting Company.